Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm Doug Berkey, Executive Director of Mitchell Institute. Here on Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. If you like learning about aerospace power, you're in the right place. So to our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thanks so much for joining us. And as a reminder, if you like what you hear, please do us a favor and follow our show and give us a like and leave a comment so we can keep charting the trajectories that matter most to you. This week, we're honored to host Lieutenant General Rick Moore, Deputy Chief of Staff for Plans and Programs at Headquarters U.S. Air Force, and Lieutenant General Sean Bratton, the Deputy Chief of Space Operations, Strategy, Plans, Programs, and Requirements at Headquarters United States Space Force. You know, translate those titles into English, and these are the leaders in charge of aligning the Air Force and Space Force's requirements with available resources. I mean, they're all about the money and lining that up to mission. And partners they work with here are throughout government. I mean, you've got broader DoD, Office of Management Budget, and now, you know, Congress, and they've got the budget request. And the saying goes, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. So these two individuals are the linchpin to that effort. Now, as everyone knows, the federal budget was sent to the Hill last week, and that kicks off an intense season of hearings and committee work, which ultimately nets the defense bills. So how many aircraft we get, how we're able to upgrade our satellite constellations, readiness issues, and strength questions, that's all up for adjudication over the next few months. And that impacts the process of what national defense looks like in the out years so significantly. And so it's our honor to host General Bratton and General Moore to better understand what the services ask for and why. And so, gentlemen, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Also joining me for today's conversation are our very own Lieutenant General Dave Deptula and General Kevin Chilton. They both had time in the programming world, so they get the pressures in play here. And as always, great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, well, thanks, Doug. It should be a great session. And Sean and Rick, as always, thanks for all you do.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for leading us here today. And appreciate you, Sean and Rick. I still have scar tissue from being a programmer, so God bless you for what you do for your respective services.
Thanks, sir.
Hey, glad to be here. It's always good to be back.
So I'll kick things off, if it's okay with you, Dave. Begin the discussion with the big picture, I think, would be best, and then we'll try to drill down into some of the details. Sean, you know, it's no secret the Space Force faces an immense challenge right now, as the service basically works to build a whole new architecture of satellite constellations. The adversary, and then you pair that with the adversary threat, new missions demand, like putting moving target indications from air-breathing platforms to space. It makes us a tremendously consequential era. How do you see these challenges reflected in the budget this year?
Yes, sir. Thanks. And like I said, it's great to be back here with the Mitchell Institute. We've been busy and we continue to be busy. You know, this is my first year in the job, and so I'm certainly on the steep part of the learning curve. But I'll tell you, General Saltzman's been clear, and his vision of enduring competition and what we need to get after, I think, is reflected in this budget. We need to continue doing the things that we've always done. And you see that in places, especially in missile warning, missile track investments. And we can talk in detail about those if you want. But also our need to get after this space superiority mission, really to pivot the force to that wartime capability we need. And we're starting to make some of those moves. And you see that reflected in parts of the budget. So we're excited about where we are. There's certainly a lot more work to do for the force.
Hey, Rick, let's switch to the Air Force here for a second. It's been said that for a long time that it's really too small to do what the nation asks of it and what the threat demands are, given our interest. You know, our geriatric fighters are aging out fast, so there's a drop in capability at a time when threats are on the rise. And I know everyone in the service wants more new iron faster, but the money is what it is, and you're assigned a bogey. So how do you articulate the risk in play regarding the need to modernize at scale when you're testifying in front of Congress?
Yeah, so thanks for the question. We appreciate it, and I too am glad to be back at the Mitchell Institute. I think the Air Force is too small for what the nation is asking, but it's also too old. As you mentioned, with the fighter fleet as an exemplar, most of our fighters are beyond their service life. 44% of the fleets in the Air Force are beyond their service life, and the average age of our fighter fleet is nearing 30 years. And so it's a challenge to help folks understand that keeping old equipment around is not just a problem with dollars. We do need to pivot dollars to the future, and we do need to pivot dollars to modernization. But really what we need is to get the airmen that are involved in fixing and flying old airplanes into the future. And so it's true that the iron is not coming as quickly as we would like. The modernization program is not moving as quickly as we like. Part of that is because of restrictions against retaining legacy force structure. And part of it is because the defense industrial base has done exactly what we've asked over the last two or three decades. They've gotten really lean and really tight. And so the production capacity is constrained. So we have to work through this. The fleet that we have, much of it will not go to China. And so we've got to convert ourselves and our airmen and our dollars to things that will.
Thanks for that.
Hey, Sean, switching to the space domain, which is now recognized as a true warfighting domain, one of the first priorities for any warfighter in any domain is domain awareness, or as we used to call situational awareness, where the adversary is, what they're, where, how they're maneuvering, what we anticipate their intent to be, et cetera. And we live in an adversary now. Our adversaries are acting incredibly aggressive on orbit, with on-orbit terrestrial-based weapons and cyber weapons that are clearly aimed at denying our terrestrial warfighters the benefits they've always enjoyed from our space, key space capabilities. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this budget looks to enhance space domain awareness.
Yeah, thanks, sir. I'll tell you, there's a couple things going on in this budget, and it all goes to, you know, one of the tenets of that enduring competition, which is avoid operational surprise, just like you described. Mm-hmm. We got to understand what's happening in the domain, and you well know the scope of the area that we got to observe to understand what the adversary is doing. What activities are occurring in the space domain is pretty significant. So we continue to invest and modernize our legacy systems. At the same time, we got to add some capability so we can really keep track of those high value assets or things that are of high interest to the commanders in the field. And so across the budget, you see just a little over $1 billion invested in the space domain awareness portfolio. There's some new investment there and pretty exciting. There's some partnerships there with countries in the Pacific region where we're starting to really work with our allies on developing capabilities in this area. And so as we lay into the Deep Space Advanced Radar capability, or DARC as we call it, that's one of the newer capabilities that's part of that $1.2 billion investment from the Space Force. But also the maintaining of those older systems is just critical to us. And so we're excited about that. We're excited about the partnerships. We do think this increases our ability, probably not as far as we need to go in the space domain awareness. We certainly need increased reaction time, increased investment in processing of all this data. And finally, it's just another area where we think there's an opportunity to leverage commercial capabilities. There's a lot of folks looking up in the sky, and if we can get access to that data and combine it with what we provide kind of internally to the Space Force, we think that's a stronger position to be in. And so there is some investment as well in the commercial enterprise to really get after what they're providing to us.
Thanks, Sean. Sounds like a win-win for the commercial as well as for our allies. It makes so much sense to bring them, both groups, into this critical mission area.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. That's all in the partner to win line of effort, and we're all about it.
Hey, Rick, with the Nunn-McCurdy breach of Sentinel this year, that obviously put more pressure on the Air Force's budget. Recapitalizing two legs of the triad plus nuclear command, control, and communications, not optional. It's an absolute imperative. So how does the service make room for these increased funding requirements? And I'm sure our audience would be interested is in if OSD would offer any top line relief in this regard.
Yeah, so we'd be interested in that as well. Certainly the Nunn-McCurdy breach is an important thing that we'll have to work through with OSD. And the biggest of the impact of that, it was not in the 25 program. It will be in the 26 and out program. Much of it, because the bulk of what that centered around was the civil work side of redeveloping the missile fields, that may even be outside the 26 FYDP. But certainly the biggest of those impacts will come as we build the 26 Palm. I don't know what OSD's perspective will be on this. I think that it is, as you said, a national imperative. We have not been given the choice in the Air Force about whether or not we're going to have a triad. And if we're going to have a land leg, we're going to have Sentinel. Minuteman III is simply not extendable, as most of the folks on the line know. It's a 10-year weapon system in its 51st year of life. So it's time for us to get to something modern that can although we would assert very strongly that Minuteman III is safe, secure, and reliable, we need to get something that can be maintained in that state with a heck of a lot less input from our airmen to keep it in tip-top condition. So we'll have to get to Sentinel. That will imply that trades will have to be made. We haven't identified yet the magnitude or the shape of the bill that goes along with the Nunn-McCurdy breach. But when we do, it will, as you rightly assert, have a substantial impact on the program.
Thanks for that.
So General Moore, General Bratton, I mean, readiness is obviously a huge priority for both services. Could you walk us through how you handle the need to fight tonight in this budget? I mean, you know, especially as the Department of the Air Force is making the shift to great power competition, it's a challenge.
It is a challenge. And what we were able to do in the 25 program was keep the foundational accounts, including the readiness accounts, from degrading beyond where they were in 24. So we were able to keep them at about the same percentage of funded requirements from 24 into 25. If you look at the rest of the budget horizon, though, 26 through 29, what you'll see is a profile in the readiness accounts. Some of them flat won't execute. The weapon system sustainment funding, I think, is a good example. It's funded at 87% in the budget year. Even if it were level across the FYDP at 87%, we would lose 2% aircraft availability across the Air Force. But it's not level. It declines actually from 87% to 74% at the end of the FYDP. And we don't have data for what happens to aircraft availability at that level because it's below what we saw in sequestration. So we were able to maintain the readiness accounts at the same level of funding in terms of requirements that we had in 24. But we have a lot of work to do when we open the books in 26 to make sure we can sustain that.
Yeah, I think for the Space Force side, you know, it's near and dear to my heart coming out of STARCOM, seeing this continued push for developing the range architecture, the operational test and training infrastructure that we need to really generate readiness for Space Operations Command. And General Miller's at Spock now, who, you know, following General Whiting's elevation up to U.S. Space Command, and he is really demanding of, he needs advanced training capabilities to get the crew force ready for their commit phase rotations in the force generation cycle. And so I'm excited. I think the investment aligns with those priorities. We continue to build out the National Space Test and Training Complex that STARCOM runs, but also investment in instructors, in additional simulation capability, beginning to really develop that environment. In some ways, we're learning a lot from the Air Force and their investment in the joint simulation environment and things like AFSIM, and how do we leverage those in the Space Force? So you see in the budget continued investment in OTTI itself, but also some commitment to developing instructors and even over on the education side, really, that really, I think, ties to where the Secretary is driving us on great power competition, increasing some activities on the developmental education arena.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And, you know, General Moore, back to you. I mean, you really can't see the cost of the budget caps. I mean, it's tough to choke down that much deferred modernization for so many decades and then, all, you know, the pivot to the Pacific and now this. So
it's, yeah, I think that's accurate. And I think we see not just deferred modernization, we also see deferred sustainment, we see deferred development. And what we will eventually see is that catching up with us. We have, like the Space Force, spent a pretty good bit of resources making sure that where we're not able to do live training, that we can do the really highest level of virtual training. You'll see over $1 billion going into the joint simulation environment this year. And there are a lot of things that we can train in the joint simulation environment that we will never train in open air, partly because of the density of threats required, partly because of the range space required, and partly because of the emissions that we don't want to cause. So there are gains in our budget, but we were not able to sustain all of the procurement that we intended to have in this round of the budget. We're short 6 F-35s, 6 F-15EXs, some MH-139s, and those are part of the modernized force that we are counting on in the event that we have to confront a great power.
I appreciate it.
Hey, Rick, here's another item that might catch up with us sometime. in a not too good way. There's been a perennial about 2,000 fighter pilot shortfall, plus those that we do have in service are pretty junior, which spreads our experienced pilots pretty thin. Does this budget get any closer to solving that challenge?
So I think that challenge is largely being solved. You won't see the bulk of the solution in the budget, but Air Education and Training Command and General Robinson in particular put a lot of energy into this. And we've talked for a long time about UPT 2.5. We don't call it UPT 2.5 anymore. It's just UPT because it's been fully implemented. And now the next generation of UPT iterations is in work at Air Education and Training Command. So I think the fundamentals of the pilot training or the pilot shortage, I don't know that we've necessarily addressed those to the extent that will change the balance. We would like to do that. I think what we find is the ability to increase capacity has so many variables that all need to be addressed at once that it becomes a problem too big to work in one single budget cycle. But there is a lot of progress going on, and I think we'll see a continuation of that in the next couple of rounds.
Thank you.
Hey, Sean, if I could go back to the manpower personnel side of the budget submission. You know, back in the day, before we looked at this as a warfighting domain, we had a pretty thin force, and that's really all we needed to make sure that the satellites, as were operating as designed, and the ground crews were just checking them periodically to make sure there are no malfunctions that could be worked around. But now, when you have an active adversary, it seems like there's a huge demand on training and increasing the skill sets to be able to defend those constellations and the new constellations that are being put up. There's a demand for intelligence to be able to assess the threat and predict enemy activities, not to mention the need to develop true warfighting skills for the offensive side of the element. There's only so much a small group of people, no matter how dedicated they are, can execute. How does the budget get after this new, what I would call new manpower personnel requirements?
Yes, sir. I think there's two drivers that we face there as we think about that. One is in the force generation model. You know, when I grew up as a space operator, we were just on console every day, all day. And anytime I was on crew or going into work, we were just on console working. And so there was no time set aside for advanced training activities. And we were able to do that because we weren't facing the threats that the crew force faces today. And so there's a demand signal for personnel on the Space Force generation model so that we have enough crew force that we can pull folks off the line to be able to increase their readiness and conduct those advanced training activities that they need to be able to do in wartime. And so there's a little bit of a requirement at the squadron level on crew for more operators to meet that. And to make them effective, you got to have the cyber operators, you got to have the intel operations piece. And then there's also this new mission growth area. And so the development of new capabilities, the demands on the Space Force to move beyond just the traditional service provider of PNT and SATCOM is the other area. So there is growth in this budget year, I think 400 Guardian growth. We got to be careful on the service side that we don't try and bite off more than we can chew there. The throughput for basic training and with the Air Force's help for ROTC and the Air Force Academy, we got to really measure the amount of Guardians that we grow in any given year to make sure the training pipeline can absorb them. But we think we're in a good place. This 400 number is exactly what we're hoping to see and what we got. I think I'd expect to see continued small growth in the out years, and we'll sort of see how that unfolds. And then you also see investment in the instructors needed to bring those Guardians up to speed in the early part of their training cycle.
Thanks.
Hey, this one's really for both of you. We've been talking about advanced battle management and combined joint all domain command and control for a long time. How does this budget get us closer to an operational level of capabilities for these two areas?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll start that and hand it to Rick, because we are working hard on this and we're really hand in hand with the Air Force on this. The Secretary's push in the operational imperatives are reflected here pretty clearly on the Space Force needing to provide the infrastructure that makes the DAF Battle Network or ABMS, JADC2, that makes all of that work. And so we're working hard on the communication part of that, the Space Data Network. The Space Development Agency is just right in the middle of that, and we had great launches this year with Tranche 0 going up. And so You see continued investment for Space Data Network, almost entirely in support of the other services, and in particular in support of the Air Force's concept for the DAF Battle Network.
So I absolutely agree with Sean that the Air Force and the Space Force are hand in hand here. And certainly neither of us will be able to accomplish our ABMS goals by ourselves. But I think a couple of things. First of all, we do have the first tangible instantiation of an ABMS product now. It's a cloud-based command and control. It's online at the Eastern Air Defense Sector in New York. So ABMS is no longer a thing of the future. The first operational parts of ABMS are delivering, and they are being used on a daily basis. So I'm really excited about that. I'm excited that we've got some hardware in the field, and I'm excited that we've got some airmen ringing it out. The next thing is, in this budget cycle, I think the character of our discussion changed. There's been a lot of analysis as we get more insight into what a potential fight might look like. And so we've been able to move past a conversation of platforms and weapons, and we've been able to move to a conversation about what it takes to actually fulfill a long-range kill chain, all the way from sensing to shooting. And so with that analysis, we were able to see places where we have strengths in the long-range kill chain and places where we might have some gaps or some weaknesses. And the investment in this budget, such as it was, smaller than we would like for it to be, but certainly there was investment that we made, that went into the places in the long-range kill chain that it takes to be able to do an entire kill chain from one end to the other. And I don't mean to imply that we only have to do that once. Part of it was to be able to do that thousands of times in hundreds of hours to be able to do it at scale. And I think the things that we would consider ABMS, several of the places where we invested in the long-range kill chain based on this year's analysis were things that are what we would characterize as ABMS. And really what it is the ability to move data to decision makers within the speed of relevance so that we can engage targets at the speed of relevance.
Sean, the idea of space superiority is an increasingly important imperative given what our adversaries are doing to counter our advantages in space. And starting as far back as World War II, we've seen how air superiority is a key imperative for any successful joint operation, whether it be on land or sea. And I'd argue space superiority is just as important, if not even more so. I recognize it's a really sensitive subject to talk about, but can you comment on any of this, either with programs, training, constellation, architecture, investments, or other focus areas with regard to the offensive side?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think General Saltzman points to this as really the number one priority as we work to pivot the force and deal with this warfighting domain. We think about space superiority, and usually you go to space on space kind of things, but the real way we're thinking about it is, how is the adversary using space to gain advantage against the joint force? How are they able to find and fix our ships and sailors, our airmen and aircraft that are out there in the field? The adversary is using space to find and fix those for targeting purposes, and we got to gain and maintain space superiority to deny that advantage to any potential adversary. So that is job one, is how do we defeat the adversary's ability to leverage space to quite frankly, you know, kill Americans and destroy our equipment. And so we got to think about how do we do that. And this budget does start to move us in that direction. And then the second piece, of course, is they're trying to do the same thing to us. They're trying to defeat our space advantage. And we've seen, you know, demonstrations of that. We talk about all the time with direct send ASAT testing out of Russia and China. And so we have to be able to defeat those threats that are coming after us. And so there is a move into this budget area. This is new mission area that requires growth in the Space Force budget. And we've seen some of that. There's certainly more to go. And then right with it, you pointed at it, sir, with the respect to the training, we have to train the force to be able to execute these missions, just like every other service has done and does so well in their respective domains. The Space Force needs to do this with the Guardians in the space domain. And so investment in the range, investment in advanced training abilities, but investment in no-kidding kit to conduct space superiority mission is really critical for us. And we are starting to really make that move. But like I said, I think we've got a ways to go still in that arena.
Thanks, Sean.
So, General Moore, you know, we see headlines about aircraft availability rates a lot. You know, oftentimes they're slamming a given airframe. And what people forget is it's a complex ecosystem. I mean, an aircraft needs to be supplied with an ample, you know, quantity of spare parts, enough maintainers, balanced set of depot capacities. And that's why we oftentimes see numbers in a combat theater higher than what we see at home station, because they're getting priority support. And, you know, the jets do great then. So how do we get after that kind of challenge in this budget? You hit on it a little earlier, but we could expand that.
Yeah. So one of the things I mentioned was that part of our goal for this year was to make sure that the foundational accounts didn't degrade from 24 into 25. So the manifestation of that was the weapon system sustainment account, the heavy maintenance account. It was about an $18 billion account in 24. In order to fund the same percentage of requirements in 25 with fewer tails, it's a $19 billion account. So we all kind of like to think that COVID is past us, but workforce, supply chain, and inflation are still very much with us. And the major accounts in the Air Force, from the weapon system sustainment account to the military personnel account to the operations and maintenance account, they are growing faster than the rate of inflation, especially when you consider that because of the Fiscal Responsibility Act, our top line actually went down. And we have a view of 26, by the way, and it is not going to get better. Keeping up with the big accounts as they grow faster than the rate of inflation, we're just simply not able to do it. And so this is why the phenomenon that I talked about for degrading weapon system sustainment funding across the FYDP, this is why it exists. And the amount of money that it takes to make it right is going to be a real challenge. I don't know that that will be able to come from the Air Force's base budget, but we will not be allowed, we will not be able to continue to degrade the readiness accounts. We'll get to the point, as I mentioned, where they just simply won't execute. And absent some repair that we're able to do in 26, by the end of the FYDP, that's where we're going to be. So I have grave concerns about this as well, especially when you consider that in the sustainment enterprise, money invested now doesn't make a change now. Money invested now makes a change in 1 or 2 or 3 years. And so potentially that means we haven't seen the worst of this. And as we continue to underinvest, I think that is going to continue to be a challenge. But we haven't been able to turn the tide yet. And until we do, we're still 1 or 2 or 3 years away from any tangible improvement in aircraft availability.
And you know, I remember what happened with the Budget Control Act about over a decade ago. I mean, it took us years to get out of that hole. So
it did.
Is tough. Thank you.
Hey, Sean, you know, missile warning and tracking is a tremendously important mission, as obviously, as you know. Then at the strategic level, you think about the nuclear threat, you know, given the nuclear breakout by China and the nuclear modernization by the Russians, not to mention Iran and North Korea, those growing threats from there. But also, it's just as important, I would suspect, at the conventional, in the conventional fight, at the operational tactical level, given the Chinese surface-to-surface threats that will hold both our fleets at risk as well as our forward-deployed forces in the Western Pacific. How are we doing on that front in the budget of missile warning and tracking, both for the nuclear deterrent, but also for the conventional fight?
Yes, sir. The you know, I grew up as a missile warning operator in that, and you'll remember that pivot when we really went from strategic missile warning and we began to also do theater missile warning. So I'm an old alert guy from back in the day when we figured out how to use DSP in new ways. We're sort of in another pivot now. So, you know, maybe the third era of missile warning where we add missile tracking into the mix. And so there's a huge commitment in this budget between missile warning, missile track, and SATCOM. You know, those are equally the two biggest portfolios that we deal with. Probably about 20% of the budget lives here. And the pivot you're seeing is to the more resilient, proliferated approach that SDA is leading us to with the development of their, you know, Tranche 0, Tranche 1 architecture. And so, like the previous budget years, we maintain that commitment to this mission area. This is entirely for the protection of the joint force. And now with missile tracking, you know, the ability to understand those advanced threats that the joint force is facing so they can defend against those things. And so a lot of money in the 25 budget year going to this, continuing what we saw in the previous years. And I think that, you know, that will continue into the out years as well.
And by advanced threats, Sean, you're referring to some of the hypersonic technologies, the maneuvering vehicles that can hold our forces at risk.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Rick, let me ask a related question. What about air and missile defense for our bases, especially in the Pacific? I know it's a complex issue, and it's not just about the Air Force. I mean, that mission was originally an Army function, but as an Air Force priority, if we really want to get it done, we're going to have to do it ourselves. So how are we doing?
Yeah, so I'm not sure the only way to do it is to do it ourselves. I think there's been a lively discussion over the last couple of budget cycles about how this division is going to occur in the Pacific. And I think where the Department of Defense has settled is we, the Air Force, will do passive defense in the Pacific. In Europe, we're doing a few different things. But in the Pacific, we'll largely do passive defense. And then we'll do, if it's active defense, non-kinetic active defense. And good old-fashioned base defense from the ground with kinetic weapons. We think that the Army has been assigned that responsibility by DOD. They've been given some money to do it. It's not easily done, especially when you consider the kinds of weapons that will be coming in the mass that's associated with that. So I don't think it's as simple as just saying do it and then magically we're ready to defend ourselves from air threats. But we are working closely with the Army. They are working closely with us. And I think we'll head for a joint solution here that will make a lot more sense than either service trying to do it on their own.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Thanks very much.
Sean, getting satellites up into orbit is step one when it comes to work in your domain. But this budget looks like the funding for launches has come down a bit. Can you speak to this decrease?
Yes, sir. I don't think there's anything going on there other than we just had less demand in this budget year. I think we're buying 11 launches in this year. Four of those are Space Development Agency launches. That's just sort of what we needed for this year, given the readiness of the programs to put those spacecraft up in orbit. And so, we're happy with the providers. There's great work going on in the launch business, and I think we're in good shape for this budget year.
Just following up on that, can you speak to the balance in using the traditional large-scale providers like and how SpaceX, ULA, and some of the newer, smaller launch capabilities are coming in to support the launch mission?
Yeah, I think it's, one, we can't lose sight of, hey, how difficult this is just to get something off the ground and into space. And you know that certainly better than I do. But the continued success of the launch industry to successfully place things in orbit, without any accidents, it's really going well. We are interested always in new entrants. We ran a program called Victus Nox, where we're starting to do some more rapid, smaller launches that opened up kind of the playing field of some new starts and some new folks in the launch business. So I think you'll see continued opportunity and continued investment, not just for the two big players in the launch business, but for some of the smaller players as well.
And some of these smaller launch providers, I would assume, give you an opportunity to move away from our two main launch sites, which are both on the coast, both vulnerable, to give you other options to put satellites in space. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that is a fair assessment. I think the resiliency of our launch infrastructure is something that, that warrants a look that we got to pay attention to. Are we accepting any vulnerabilities there that if we moved into conflict, I think we need to think a little bit more about that going forward in the out years.
Thank you.
Rick, one of the most important Air Force investments is the B-21. Given the nature of the threats that we face, is the Air Force considering any options to invest in additional production capacity now, given that there are going to be long lead times to set up that potential?
Yeah, so we're kind of in that phase. I would never say that the B-21 program is fragile. It's performing very, very well. It's in flight test. No complaints whatsoever, but we're not quite confident yet enough in the timeline for the aircraft exiting flight test. It is with the B-21, as you know, event-driven and not time-driven, that we're ready to start putting additional procurement dollars in. But when the time comes, we would like to get the B-21 as quickly as we can, and whatever we can afford to do to accelerate procurement of the B-21, you'll likely see us do it because, number one, it'll allow us to move away from the legacy platforms faster, and number two, a big increase in capability, as you certainly well know, to get the B-21 into the fleet. So we'll do that as expeditiously as possible. We're still in the kind of let's see how flight test goes phase, but there's certainly no indication that anything is happening other than the airplane performing very well in flight test.
Thanks.
Hey, Sean, I know you worried a lot about the training in your last job, and you've already commented a bit on this, but I was just wondering if there was anything else you'd like to add in light of space becoming a warfighting domain, with regard to personnel and training and assets for that, whether it be curriculum, instructors, schoolhouses, physical infrastructure, opportunities to train at the command and control level at the operational level of war, simulators, ranges. There's just so many things that we didn't really need before it was a warfighting domain. And now the list seems to just go on and on.
Yes, sir. I think there's a couple things going on there that influence our thinking. One is that we have far greater interaction with the combat commands today than we've had before. And you see that as we begin to establish the service components, the Space Force service components to each of the combat commands. And we're not quite halfway through that process now, but we're certainly supporting U.S. Space Command, obviously, and then INDOPACOM and UCOM and CENTCOM. And that creates new demands on both training for guardians and in understanding interacting with the joint force. But maybe more than that is the demands for exercises and wargaming. And so getting guardians in support of those operational plans that they live in the combatant commands, the interaction with that. So it utilizes our test and training infrastructure that we talked about before, but now we're really active in those, and the demand really far exceeds our capacity right now in just making guardians available, because job one will always be readiness of the force on crew, you know, operating, protecting, defending our space assets. And so we're trying to find that right balance of how do we enable guardians to get out there and participate in these things, get the experience they need with the joint force, but also we got to keep the crew force on console flying our spacecraft and making sure those things are safe. And so there's a balance there, but the activities do create a demand signal. The new component commands are creating a demand signal for sort of advanced training in the exercise arena, where traditionally maybe we played a lot in Red Flag and sort of within the departmental exercises. We're really getting out there a lot more these days.
Great. And just listening to you, it sounds like it demands new manpower billets, as well as you address the absorption issue that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, it does. We're working through, you know, really the Space Force Generation Model is job one. The tricky thing as we field the component field commands, and the S1 team is doing a lot of modeling on this. And quite honestly, we're learning from the other services, the Air Force in particular, but those are all senior billets, right? So field grade officers, NCOs, senior NCOs, and the ability to absorb junior folks that you bring in through basic training or the academy or OTS or ROTC to generate a future lieutenant colonel that I need, to support UCOM. How do we ensure the sustainability of the force, but create those field grade officers and senior NCOs that we need? We're learning a lot in how that business works. And we got some great teammates helping us think through it, but that really is the trick on forecasting our future needs at the senior ranks and making sure that we can absorb those folks in the junior ranks to create a 20-year colonel.
Rick, here's something that's right up your alley, at least in terms of background, and that's regarding our mobility forces. It seems like we can never have enough booms in the air. If you look back in history, the IOC for the C-17 was declared over 30 years ago. We're also looking at a new tanker concept with Jet Zero. And then concepts like agile combat employment and a possible or high probability of mobility combat attrition are going to stress the capacity of our mobility force. So how does the mobility force fare in the budget?
Yeah, so I think we're relative to the risk in other portfolios, I think we're reasonably comfortable with the size of the tanker and the airlift fleets. I think we're certainly not comfortable with their age. As you know, the youngest KC-135 we own was made in 1964. The C-5s are certainly showing their age, and multiple of our C-17s have passed one lifetime based on the telemetry that comes off the airplane. So we are looking at a next-gen tanker concept, but really the most important priority in the air refueling portfolio is continuous recapitalization of 135s. And AQ and AMC and the Secretary are working really hard to make sure that as the KC-46 contract reaches its end, we're able to continue buying some kind of tanker to continue retiring the KC-135s. We'll look to what comes next, and we are looking at the next generation air refueling system. There's about $7 million in the budget to continue an analysis of alternatives to look at in-gas And then NGAL, Next Gen Airlifter, is on the horizon as well. So we got work to do to make sure that we're able to get to the future. But right now, what is the most important thing, I think, is preserving what we have and continuing to recapitalize our oldest mobility assets. Say that I'll just add on that one of the most important things, I think, from General Menahan's perspective at Air Mobility Command is connectedness. The 135s in particular, as well as the airlifters, but they are not particularly well connected back through the ABMS architecture to command and control. And so you'll see a strong emphasis over the next couple of years on getting connectivity to be a part of the baseline for the mobility fleet.
John, Mitchell Space recently released a report championing the importance of space-based terrestrial environment monitoring. Weather is a foundational but often out-prioritized mission area as far as assets in space supporting the terrestrial warfighter. We all know DMSP is on its last legs with no plan B in the immediate future. Are we prioritizing the next gen solutions in this particular budget?
Yeah, we sure are. I know from my days in the Air Force, certainly you all know every step brief starts with the weather brief and then followed by intel. And so easy for that to get lost in all the exciting things we're going on, but we have to continue to deliver these foundational capabilities, and weather is one of those. And there's a lot of people in the weather business, but the Space Force is in there too. There is work in this budget for the weather system follow-on, and I think some prototype work for the EOIR weather system to the tune of a little over $100 million. And so we are focused on that. We know the Joint Force, not just the Air Force, but certainly the Army and the Navy are dependent on that weather information for their operations. And so I think you see commitment from the Space Force to keep after that.
Thanks. And I think a lot of folks would mistake what we see on television, weather reports from pictures from space, mistake that kind of coverage is adequate for the terrestrial warfighter when in fact it's not. They need much more precise information when it comes to looking at the environment. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And also, the Joint Force operates globally, and we got to provide that information no matter where they are on the surface of the Earth, not just in the United States. And so important that we continue to invest in that area.
Great.
Rick, we all know, and we kind of touched on it earlier, that the Air Force is too small to meet the demands of the current national defense strategy. But at the same time, the Air Force doesn't have the TOA necessary to rapidly solve that challenge. So how are you approaching this quandary? I get it. Those of us who have been programmers get it. You got a top line. You need to balance the budget. But can you speak to the risk that this involves? I mean, and obviously things like multiple CRs and budget caps certainly don't help.
Yeah, so one of the toughest things for us to work around is the CRs, as you mentioned. In the last 12 years, we spent four of those 12 years in CR. Twice since 1977, we've had a budget in normal order. We're simply giving time to our adversaries, and they don't have this problem. So, we're very excited that the draft appropriations bill hit this week. But by the way, it's the last half of March. And so we've got to have budgets in normal order. For every month the Department of Defense spends in a continuing resolution, it costs $12 billion in buying power. It is anything but the way to run a government. Beyond that, it is true that the budget authority is not there for us to modernize as quickly as we would like. We would say that one of the most important things is that we put the budget authority that we have to the best use. I think you can look, speaking of the appropriations bill, you can look at the draft appropriations bill, and you see things like combat rescue helicopters that the Air Force neither asked for nor wanted. In fact, we specifically asked that they not be added to the budget. I don't know anybody else, but I'm not interested in flying around the Pacific in a machine that refuels behind a C-130 at 115 knots. That doesn't seem to me like something that's part of great power competition. And so it's a combination of using the money that we have in the right way, and then eventually we'll have to buy the Air Force that we want. And the Fiscal Responsibility Act, I think, by reducing our top line, has set back the modernization program. We understand that there are national needs that drive the amount of resources that can be dedicated to defense. So we understand that. There is, however, an impact on modernization. We're not complaining, but we are calling out the fact that our modernization program has slowed because of that.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll just add to that, and Rick has helped me learn this. Like I said, this is my first year in the seat here and just a couple months in, and, you know, a little bit maybe naivete even on my part on understanding the impact of these things as we're already starting on the 26 budget. We're waiting for 25, but really 24 is unresolved. And so the ability to plan those future years, which is our job, is and set the course for the service is really impacted by the delays that we see in the CR. And, you know, I think I walk in his office like, hey, how are you able to do this with so much uncertainty that is out of our control? And so, you know, I think wisdom prevails on, hey, there's the reality that you got to deal with, but it sure is unpleasant. It sure makes our lives difficult. And I think it's, you know, not the best way to execute the taxpayers' money.
Well, if I can make an editorial comment, I think those last two statements are kind of the highlight of the challenges that you face. Maybe addressing a bit of good news, Rick, collaborative combat aircraft are seen as a possible way to gain affordable mass. I believe there's about $160 million in the budget for collaborative combat aircraft. Does that keep you on track for the overarching CCA plan?
It does. And certainly there's a lot more money behind that in the rest of the budget horizon, the rest of the FYDP. So, and as you mentioned, the premise behind this is affordable mass. If you consider the size of the Pacific AOR and what kind of force will be required to confront an adversary, you will not be able to do that. You won't be able to build that mass if you're building with F-35s, MB-21s, and NGAD. Inner CCAs and the ability to bring the average cost of that fleet down dramatically. As you said, affordable mass. We're excited about these prospects. And although the first thing that we're looking at in the realm of CCAs is the ability to augment the shooters, there are lots of other things that CCAs can do, and we're excited about those as well. So more to follow on that and a substantial investment by the Air Force.
What about munitions? It's a traditional build player, but I think the experience that we've seen in Ukraine has really driven home the need to gain and maintain sufficient stocks of modern capable munitions on hand. How's the Air Force addressing this?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, we talk about munitions being a bill payer. I'm not sure that that's the case. I think what we've seen is a pivot away from low-end munitions like SDB-1 and, you know, just general purpose bomb bodies with GPU-38 tail kits on them towards advanced munitions. And not all of that is visible in the budget. So there's that. And I think just the fact that we've stopped procuring low-end munitions doesn't mean that we've gone there to pay bills. So I will also say that although we spend about $7 billion a year, about $35 billion across the FYDP on munitions, advanced munitions are very expensive. What you will also see in this budget, though, is a pretty good bit of facilitization money to increase our capacity to produce weapons. We saw, as you mentioned with Ukraine, that when we wanted to surge, there was little, if any, surge capacity. So there's a pretty good bit of facilitization money coming in. We would like to put more. We would like to be able to build capacity, even though we know that we don't intend to procure off of it, so that we have the ability to surge. That has not played particularly well with Department of Defense, and it hasn't played particularly well with the Hill, but it's something that we'll continue to work on because we really do believe that we need to have some surge capacity. You will see a good bit of investment in munitions in this year's portfolio.
Well, gentlemen, we are getting a little tight on time here, so I'll take the privilege here of asking one last question for both of you. If you had an extra dollar, or I think perhaps an extra pile of dollars, it sounds like is what you need, where would it go?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll start with that one. Space superiority is the key. I mean, we've got significant investment in missile warning, missile track, significant investment in satellite communications, those things that the Joint Force needs, but we have to be able to defend those capabilities. And so I think without a doubt, that is where the Space Force needs to go. And that's where those extra dollars would go for us. It's a new mission. And so I think we look forward to, hopefully look forward to growth in that area going forward.
Yeah. And I would say either today or Monday, the Chief's unfunded priorities list will be transmitted to the Hill. And that is our statement of where we would put additional dollars. I'm not trying to be cryptic, but I also don't want to get ahead of the Chief. And I think what you'll see is there are a lot more requirements than dollars. That's not certainly unique to the Air Force or any of the services. But I think you'll see our problem exacerbated this year by the Fiscal Responsibility Act and the reduction in our top line. It appears that there will be appropriations bills signed that will keep sequestration from coming into effect. it's lost on many that there was a sequestration component to the Fiscal Responsibility Act. It is also lost on many that there was not just 1 year of that. There is a sequestration clause for FY25 as well. So we're certainly not out of the woods on this. There is risk again of sequestration in FY25.
Now, gentlemen, this has been fantastic. I really can't thank you enough for your time, your candor. You've got a really tough job in front of you. And so thanks for taking the time to share some thoughts with us.
Thanks for the invite.
And both of you, best of luck on the Hill. And thanks very much again to taking the time to spend this very, very valuable information period. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
From my side, please pass on to your teams how much we appreciate all the hard work they're doing. I've been there and watched it, and I know in a CR year, it's like constantly pushing a rock up the hill and a boulder rolling back down on you as you wait for decisions. So please pat your teammates on the back there and thank them for all the great work they're doing for national security.
We'll do it, General, and thanks for that.
And with that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. And if you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas that you think we should explore further. And as always, you can join the conversation by following Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.